This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Zen of Creativity by Daido Roshi. Creativity is our birthright. It is an integral part of being human, as basic as walking, talking, and thinking. Every human contains its seeds and is constantly manifesting it, whether we are preparing Sunday dinner, painting a canvas, walking down the avenue, programming a computer. The creative process, like the spiritual journey, is intuitive, nonlinear, and experiential. It points us toward our essential nature, which is a reflection of the boundless creativity of the universe. So today I would like to speak about art practice. Oh my God. Painting Spring is the chapter in the Eight Gates of Zen. Kind of daunting, it's so vast, but we'll see. It felt kind of like a canvas where I was taking dabs of color and just building something for this talk. And recognizing since COVID started and all the tensions that are happening, how essential it has been for expression. And knowing what we're expressing, understanding our mind in expression. And I want to express my gratitude for Daido Roshi for bringing art practice in as a gate of freedom, a gate to realize our essential nature, a way to study the self, forget the self, and realize who we are. And also this week, the residents, we watched a film, Beyond the Visible, the work of Hilma af Klint, which had my cells shaking inside for continuing now as I have a little picture of her right here to keep looking at her in her confident pose at her desk in her petticoats with her paintbrushes. Beyond the visible, all space is filled with waves. And then yesterday the residents went out to practice a bit by the river, painting, drawing, writing. So what Roshi's pointing to, in a sense, is how art practice is really how we live our life, moment to moment, as the creative being we are. The artistry, how we articulate our life, how we understand our life. Now, at the last minute, I thought this was important just to bring a little bit about the tradition and the Zen arts and historically, starting with Bodhidharma, who was considered to be, of course, the first ancestor of the Zen lineage, and how he put forth these four points to define Zen. He said, Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures, with no reliance on words and letters. No reliance on words and letters. A direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of enlightenment. So, in a sense, Zen is about the experience of Buddha's enlightenment, not the words and ideas that describe it. because we know to believe or to understand doesn't really impart much strength. So it's the direct experience. And as practitioners, that's our life, is getting closer and closer to direct experience, not through so many filters and fabrications, but just to understand how the mind creates and uncreate. So in its early history, the influences were from Taoism, the energy of nature. And then in Song Dynasty in China, this is 960 to 1279, the arts of painting and poetry reached their highest stage of development with this amazing phenomena, a novel phenomena of painter priests and poet priests who produced art that produced all forms of religious and secular art. So it was not representational or iconographical, their works. It did not inspire faith or facilitate liturgy or contemplation. It did not function to deepen the devotee's experience of religion. It was not used in worship ceremonies or a part of prayer. Its only purpose was to point to the nature of mind. So Zen masters began to use art as a way of teaching the Buddha Dharma to both monks and laity. And the monasteries became magnets for secular artists who were interested in clarifying the relationship between the deepest spiritual yearnings, the deepest questions about who they are, who am I, and creativity. So that's a little of the background of our tradition and how it's come into our practice here and influenced my life. So the creative process is taking place right now, all the time, in everyday situations, how we perceive and then express directly. And in perception, in this perception, we can identify how simple our nature is. And most of it begins with seeing impermanence, this fleeting nature. That's like the most fundamental, seeing the changing nature of who we are, this impermanence, and things. When we know what we see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and feel is fleeting, short-lived, temporary, how do we express it? How do we live that? Hilma said, we're not here forever. So we wonder what it is to be in the world. And that's kind of the question we are as a human. So in the art practice, we can be in the ever-changing present, see the elements we are more clearly, the aggregates, the five conditions, all names for the same thing, in full display, and see that our life is just like a blooming flower. Just like a flower. And when our perceptions can actually relax, and we release that impulse to make solidity, reify our perceptions and feelings, and express directly, we begin to get that sense of things as they are. And that's what we worked with yesterday, just as direct, not blocking that. I still love Alan Watts' statement about art is, I am always effing the ineffable. That's it. That's this life. We're effing the ineffable. How do we F? Suzuki Roshi had a quote I found in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where he says, "Whatever we see is changing is losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it's out of balance. But its background is always in perfect harmony." This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature. Losing its back balance against a background of perfect balance. So if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. He continues, "To understand reality as direct experience is the reason we practice Zazen. Through the study of the Buddhist teachings, you will understand your human nature, your intellectual facility, and the truth present in human activity." So I substituted art for Zazen and Buddhism. "To understand reality as direct experience is the reason we practice art. Through the study of art, you will understand your human nature, your intellectual facility, and the truth present in human activity." We train to relax in the fact of impermanence. As Hilma says, accept, 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 see, look, listen, 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 trust, being in a floating world. And this is why I love the work of Cezanne. I've spoke of him before. He says, if you want to understand reality, paint clouds. Paint clouds. And his work to me is always like something's about to. Like an orange is about to fall off the top of that still life pile of fruit on the table. Like this bottle is about to come off the edge of the table. Like someone's hand is about to put down, pick up. We don't know. So he leaves us in this, for me, this state of about to or has or what. What? He leaves me in a state of what? What? So art practice gives us a chance to wake up to the magic of our own perceptions and even wake others up. And during this time, that's been so powerful, the images that I've been looking at, to alchemize what's happening and wake us up. Wake us up. And they're not representational. Some are. It's not always literal. Could be abstract. But when the person has the feeling, it's transmitted to. Those waves go right into the paint, right through. That's, you know, get still enough so something can come through. And I know to even mention the word art, many of us get that cringe inside, that tightening art practice. I've been dealing with this for years. Or say creative expression, and everyone sort of curls up. Some don't. But many of us do, and I don't blame you, because that's been shut down quite a bit in our education. How many of us got that doesn't look like a... I did. I could have stopped. I was very young. that doesn't look like an airplane, the one I drew. Came home crying. My mother's like, what's wrong? Nothing. You don't look so good. And I held my picture up and I said, my teacher said, this doesn't look like an airplane. I've never seen my mother rally like this. She said, that's your airplane. May I have this? And she marched in and she said, please don't ever do that to a child. We have things that have been injured in our creative process. We have brutal judges that live in us, that we've taken on. And I say, like Milarepa, invite them in. Tell those judges to have a seat and express themselves. And see what happens to that judge. So the creative process is more something we discover than what we create. Looking upon it with curiosity, looking upon our lives with curiosity about where we're being led. Not stop it, not try so hard. Having an open heart and an open mind is essential in our lives. But that takes some practice and some discipline, doesn't it, to meet the complications of mind with warmth, intelligence, and discipline. Takes repetition over and over, meeting again and again. Which is that over and over again is a coming down to earth, a letting go of results. Because we don't really know. Just appreciating engagement in the process, in the senses, the aliveness of our senses. Wow. Letting go of confusion, taming the mind as we meet the complications, being humbled. That's earth. Humility, humus, earth. Humus, humility. And I think I see everyone as an artist. You know, people come, I'm not, da, 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 and I'm like, I don't buy it. Sorry. You know, I tell when people would come in for retreats, for the art retreat, I would watch as they signed in and they'd write their name just fine. And then we get to the class and it'd be like, and I'm like, where does that shift happen? Why did you write your name so easily? And then when we just draw a line, it's full of tumultuousness and panic. This is why it's such a great gate of freedom. We're constantly manifesting, as Daido Roshi said. We can't avoid being creative even if we try. And the question is, what? We're always creating something. So what? What are we creating? What are we doing? That's the important part. What's our actions? So we could say, in a sense, that art is skillful means, upaya. The skillful means is the way that we warm our heart, call it compassion, tending the heart, how we manifest in action in life to put us in direct contact with our essential nature, or as the other Roshi Suzuki says, the arts of Zen are to ultimately to put us in touch with the ultimate nature of reality. So, skillful means upaya, the warmth of our tending heart to manifest in action. And this was the word, upaya meant in Mahayana Buddhism, which is art. So Robert Thurman wrote a piece, which I found. I was so excited, and I've had it for a while, which is called The Wonderful Ambiguity of Art. And I just love how his mind describes things and tells stories. So he says, art is really far out in the case of Buddhism, especially the view of the more magical understanding of the teachings, which some might say is the Mahayana understanding. But the Theravada literature pictures the Buddha as totally magical, as when in the Avatamsaka Sutra, he appears at the Shakya kingdom to teach his father. He suddenly manifests as two Buddhas from a single ray of light emitted from his heart. Then those Buddhas, in turn, manifest into four Buddhas, and so on, until there's millions of Buddhas everywhere that you can see, which is total piece of performance art. This is the way to show people the all-pervasiveness of the Buddha's enlightened power, he says, and probably to cheer up his father, who was disappointed he had not become a world conqueror. He says, the point in terms of art is that when you go into the magical aspect of the Buddha, you see how every breath that the Buddha draws, every gesture Buddha makes, every word Buddha speaks is an artistic manifestation in the sense that none of it is driven by any sort of selfish impulse on the part of the being that was formerly Siddhartha Gautama. Everything he does is a communication of compassion of other beings to other beings, creating doorways to open up their imaginations, then their whole beings to enlightenment, to nirvana. He says you have to present nirvana first as a work of art, and that allows people to perceive it. And it opens up the possibility that we can experience it for ourselves. Who would want to seek nirvana if we couldn't imagine there was such a state as freedom from suffering? And this is what all Buddhas and all Buddha ancestors and enlightened beings have been communicating and transmitting generation after generation as we sit here right now. This art of freedom. One continuous work of art that draws us, the one beholding the practice of the Dharma, into a world of the art of learning what it is to be fully human and to be of benefit in our expressions. Gautama penetrated the veils of self. He tapped the enormous creative resources of the Buddha nature and freed the illusions of something solid, historical, substantial. As we chanted in the Heart Sutra this morning, with no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, therefore no fear, far beyond deluded thoughts. This is nirvana. So Buddha was quite an artist. So I'm very grateful to Daido Roshi for serving us what he loved, And he always said he came through Zen through the back door. You might have heard that expression. What does that for some of us? Yeah, I came to Zen through the back door. What's the back door? Well, he said being in the arts was coming in through the back door, through expression. He was a photographer studying with Minor White, who taught Zazen and meditation as being essential to the creative process and the clarity of expression, getting clear on how we and what we express, quieting the mind, deep listening to the life of things, letting the 10,000 things come forward to realize the self, not going after. Dido said, we don't take pictures. Pictures take us. We just have to show up to receive, be on that amazing receiving end. Seeing with the unconditioned eye, whereas the retreats that he taught. And I got to accompany him on many of those, which was so enjoyable to see how he led people in to a process and a process of forgetting, or to see a discipline to see the complexities and how to work those complexities into that creativity at the same time, very directly. And you'll note, he always said and saw the artist's path as the Buddha path. He would always speak of it as a way, Do, the way, Dai Do, the great way, Kyudo, the way of Bo, Zendo, the place of the way of practice, Chado, the way of tea. Someone asked me once, can you remember what your first conscious experience was? And I was like, huh. I didn't think about it too long, but what came up was warm sand and trying to walk. I felt like I remember something about like trying to walk in deep sand with these chubby little legs for a baby. Water. I remember, I don't know if this was the first conscious experience, but I remember at the shore, at the beach, airplanes that would go by and leave a white trail, a line. And I would always just stay with that line and watch it sort of spread out and move and disappear. And that touched me very deeply. I remember afterwards this funny sensation in my body of that happening. Or the buildings of castles in the sand, or writing words by the edge of the water, and the waves coming up and taking it away. I just love that. Build it up and then just melting away. Or like I'd stand there with my feet in the water and the wave would come, and then when it went back out, I felt like I was going 100 miles an hour and I was standing still. I love that feeling. And I think it embedded something about like, what is stillness? What is movement? This impermanent changing quality. And I think a love of materials developed. I love my hands in something, building something, which many of us do. I felt my body at ease while doing it. Just hours of the day could go by scratching and building and creating in such a way. So, a life formed, and art practice became my religion, so to speak. It's where I found refuge, faith, trust. I could listen. I could get quiet. I could get still in my movements. I could start to understand my mind a little bit, little by little. Something was coming clearer. And actually found my way to Buddhism through a bowl, a clay bowl, which was deeply, deeply centered, but asymmetrical. But the center of it was just so bottomless. Whatever it was, the mystery of it, I started bawling again. It just went right through me, and I was just like, who let this happen? Who did this? Whose mind made this? Whose understanding? Something was coming through. I couldn't understand that power. And we know the power of some things we've seen created. Small little things this big of somebody carving something they felt was beautiful or brought birth into life that we behold and feel something was given off. And then the black calligraphies of Zen. Where is that coming from? It just blew my mind. And then to find out they were centuries ago, whoa. Like, this is like beyond any time period. Like, this is from like the bottom of the toes and out through the head and further, wherever this explosion onto paper came from. And yet it wasn't arbitrary. There was some form that was meeting for nothing, something that wasn't there, the thing that was there meeting, that gave a whole feeling. Again, Suzuki says, when we emerge from nothing, when everything emerges from nothing, we see all as a fresh creation, a fresh new creation. This is non-attachment. The suspension of judgment and the practice of non-discriminating awareness is a state which new ideas present themselves, old ideas loosen their grip, and the force of habit can be seen for what it is. There was no habit in these things. This is Zazen. This is that original space. The being in original space and keep returning to it when we drift off, as well as being aware of what arises in that space and how to work with it and make the opening. And that's how we meet. That's how we can meet the world. We need the practice so that when we are in the creative process making things, we can understand the difference between being mindful and aware and are not just slipping into self-absorption, which can be a hindrance. Because in that, we cut off our surroundings. So this mindful awareness is open and we're not cutting off anything, so it's not narrow. You know, when we say do our work practice mindfully with awareness open, we're aware of the environment. We're not just like cutting carrots with the world shut out, because that's a hindrance. That's not where we are. We're a living, breathing, moving gravy. Amazeballs. There, I got it. We go into our head. We can tell the difference. Can you? To have a sense of stillness while being awake and aware what is happening, resting in motion, so we can glimpse things as they are, unfiltered, undistorted. And then the posture we take is giving shape to our mind. We're shaping our mind in our zazen posture. And then opening to that intuitive aspect, low down, the hara, dropping down into the hara to open up that more immediate, intuitive aspect of our being and learning how to trust it. Like we are led to what we already know, but we did not know we knew. With this whole different aspect of our being. I remember feeling this hara. I know a lot of us, when we sit down, we're like, what is the hara? Where is it? And we still be like, am I in my hara? Don't worry. Don't worry. It's the center of gravity, center of energy. It's the pivot point. You know it. You know it. Just relax into it. And I felt this so clearly working with horses, which I don't really have a strong relationship with. I just felt this imperative at one point to work with them. And I was my lesson was to walk a horse about 15 feet. Just walk, hold the reins. Very simple. Hold the rein, hold the rope, and walk the horse down to there. Turn around and come back. Talk about why we need a discipline to see the complications. I was so freaked out about this big thing on this rope from here to there. And it knew. That's what horses know. They know when you're freaked out. That's why you work with them. Because they have predators, so they have to feel vibrations. And they know if they can relax or if they should run for their life. So this horse was taking me all over the place, looking out the window, moving, going like this with its head, and just, I couldn't really control it. And I went up and back. And then the trainer said to me, so you practice Zen Buddhism, right? And I said, yeah. And they said, did you ever hear the hara? And I'm like, for God's sake, yes. They said, well, put your mind in your hara and walk the horse now again, okay? Just get your feet on the earth and walk with the hara, not your head. Another world. That horse was so calmed down. He knew just what to do. He just went along. So I tamed myself, and it just came right along with that. You know? That was just an amazing visceral feeling. I was like, oh, wow, this is so powerful. Another time I had to brush the horse, and this horse was there because it was a pain in the neck. It got trained very poorly. So what is it? It got fed a carrot every time it did something because the owner was guilty every time it yelled. It would say, oh, I'm sorry, and feed it a carrot. You did that good. Feed it a carrot. So the horse just wanted carrots. So when you came in the arena, it just bit you to get a carrot. And I had no carrots, just a brush. And I was sent in to brush the horse. Again, a simple task, brush the horse. But I got so unsafe. It started biting me and pulling down my zippers. And this is a big mouth with big teeth, just yank, yank, yank. And And they're watching me, of course. And then I remembered my task, brush the horse. And I started saying, I am brushing you. And I just started brushing the horse very directly, first vigorously. Like, and immediately, again, relax. The horse relaxed. It knew exactly what was clear and direct and what to do. As I settled into my hara and the direct expression, so to trust takes courage to emerge out of the stillness and the silence, and that the right way to act will arise, to wait with active patience, persevere through the blank space, being guided, listening with a level of perception that enables us to move. It could be a blank canvas. It could be your guitar leaning against the wall. It could be an open stage. We don't have to worry about being original. We're completely original, if you haven't figured that out. Who is like you? Who is like you, exactly like you? No one. No one has your nervous system. No one has your senses. Every being we see is a total, unique work of art. And it's just relaxing so that can, and trusting how that wants to come through. Some of you, we did breath paintings. You can do this at home if you want to start art practice. Just take a pencil or a pen or a marker in each hand and close your eyes. Have a big piece of paper. Just let your breath express itself onto the page. Just breathe it. Emphasize the movement of the inhale and the exhale as you hit the paper. Right? And so we would have 10, 20, 30, 100, 1,000, 8 million different breaths expressed. That's what's happening all the time. I was, as I said, I've been looking up artists, and I won't go into the number of them, and there's so many, and their expressions now. Washington Post ran a whole thing on expressions that are happening now, but Herbie Hancock, somebody shared this with me, has been a Buddhist practitioner. He was a member of his band, his jazz band, turned him on in 1972, and he's been practicing Buddhism since then. And he said in a recent lecture, he said, Hancock asked the question, well, what motivates creativity? And he continued to list the several main motivators: fear, pain, suffering, joy, the time clock, stress, anger, desire, humor, observation. Basically, what's left out. He argued that everyone has the capability to be a creative artist, a creative individual, especially since everyone is involved in the art of living. He specifically discussed the power of Buddhism to influence creativity, saying that the belief system, as he calls it, modifies our state of being and expands us. He ended by saying, a person that lives with imagination, hard work, innovation, along with integrity, wisdom, and compassion can be a profound contributor toward the creation of a harmonious orchestra of life. Even though the art of living is, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the most difficult to master. I found a book on State Street on a blanket. Can't resist a good blanket sale. And a big fat book of the poetry of Robert Frost, who I'm not particularly drawn to, but that was the book that was there, and it was, I had time, so I picked it up. And on the very first page, he's speaking about what a good poem does and the way it does it. He says, a good poem is a fresh look and a fresh listen. Read it 100 times, it will forever keep its freshness as a metal keeps its fragrance. You're not trying to tell a person something they didn't already know, but give them the shock of recognition. So I love that term, the shock of recognition, which I felt like that's the Buddhist teachings, giving us the shock of recognition. Art is like this. Koans are like this. Life is like this. Often we need the shock of recognizing who we are so we don't die in our repetition. And if we were open, it'll strike us unexpectedly that we see new, that we hear new, that we smell new. Not known means freshness. We can be fresh again and again and again as we meet the changes in this floating world. Sometimes the shock of recognition comes from life itself, like events. Like we're in now, so many of us shocked into recognition, shocked in our comfort zones, shocked in all the knowing, being squeezed, being released of our ideas and concepts and formulas and strategies. Teachers shout, they whack, they talk about painted rice cakes, they throw mud bowls, they put sandals on their head. Why? What for? What is this performance art? So we don't settle. So we don't settle in one more frozen conception of ourselves. They want us to be free, fresh, and alive. So in our art practice, as we've been working in our sessions, being in isolation, finding that fresh in the familiar, making it unfamiliar again, making the fresh familiar, the unfamiliar, fresh. Can we appreciate the ability to see the world fresh? And if so, that's a precious piece of wisdom you have. That's a precious piece of wisdom. Like our breakfast cook, how do you make the hot cereal every morning? A fresh experience. That's what Dido used to ask me. Hey, Hoj, how do you make the oatmeal fresh every morning? Hey, Hoj, how do you make a square pot on a spinning wheel? For the Buddha, that was his art. And the art practice that was transmitted and continues generation after generation in different forms of teaching to skillfully work with practitioners to undermine the certainty which we hold our views. And this example from the Sutra of the Buddha's Second Discourse, where he takes apart the five skandhas that we chant in Heart Sutra, form, feeling, perception, conception, and consciousness through the lens of the three marks of existence, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and no self. He says, "How do you think of this, O monks? Is form permanent or impermanent?" "Impermanent, O Lord." "Now that which is impermanent, is it unsatisfactory or satisfactory?" "Unsatisfactory, O Lord." "Now that which is impermanent, unsatisfactory, subject to change, is it proper to regard that as this is mine, this I am, this is myself?" "Indeed, not that, O Lord." He rocks our perceptions about the nature of our experience into the uncertain nature of it all. Form is neither permanent, satisfactory, or endowed with self-existence. No self was and still is one of the Buddha's revolutionary insights, anatta. He completely went against the beliefs of his cultural context. He saw fresh and new and passed this shocking newness on, offering us a much more liberative way of seeing and directly experience. And I'll end with a poem by Emily Dickinson, even though I have much more. I'll end with this. And I love this poem because in it she dissects her own perception. How many of us can do that? Which is perfect for today. "Like rain, it sounded till it curved, and then I knew 'twas wind. It walked as wet as any wave, but swept as dry as sand. When it had pushed itself away to some remotest plain, a coming as of hosts was heard. That was indeed the rain."
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.